Welcome.
You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine on Sunday, December 29th, 2024. My name is Bill McCann, and I'll continue reading some of the profiles from the lives they lived from the magazine. And James Earl Jones was born 1931. After refusing to talk for most of his childhood, he discovered power in performance. This profile is written by Reginald Dwayne Betts. When James Earl Jones was a small child, he stopped talking. He was born in Arkabutla, Mississippi, and learned to love its gullies and rises and deep ravines and the loam enriched by the Mississippi River and the way it felt against his bare feet. His parents had left him to his maternal grandparents, and when he was 5 or 6, they moved to Dublin, Michigan, reluctantly taking the boy with them. He was devastated. The move opened opportunities for the family, but was a profound rupture for the young Jones. The move from Mississippi to Michigan was supposed to be a glorious event, he remembered in his 1993 memoir, Voices and Silences. For me, it was a heartbreak. Jones would later characterize himself as mute. It's not that he couldn't speak, but when he did, it was with a terrible stutter that he developed after moving to Michigan. Before strangers, he wouldn't muster his words. I talked to my family in basic terms, he wrote. His grandmother allowed him to skip church, the only place that would force him to struggle through words during those years. Though he refused to talk with other people, his time in Mississippi taught him to listen. Out in the country, with few books or strangers and no such thing as television, he wrote, we depended on the stories we knew. His grandmother told bedtime stories about women cursed to wear the heads of mules and men who had bellies full of writhing snakes. His family spoke of his great-grandparents, Wyatt Conley and Charlotte Jeter, and the 300 acres of Mississippi land they cultivated. When Jones was in high school, a poet and former college professor named Donald Crouch persuaded him to break his silence. After the teacher introduced him to the poems of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, Jones wrote an ode to grapefruit, patterned after Longfellow's Song of Hiawatha. And what might have been a bid to make the boy speak, Crouch said the poem was so good that it must have been plagiarized, a notion Jones could only dispel by reading it aloud. It turns out that poetry, like song, can help stutterers overcome disfluency, and in performance, Jones found himself able to speak. Jones went on to participate in school competitions and recitals, and sometimes reading lines of Edgar Allan Poe's verse. As he discovered his voice, he gravitated toward anything that required him to use it, public speaking, debate, oratory contests. After graduating from high school, he began his studies at the University of Michigan as a pre-med student, but medicine was simply a profession any first-generation college student might choose in 1949, not the vehicle for Jones's self-expression. After struggling with chemistry and physics, he decided to become an English major because it was the closest thing to studying drama. Though he spent 4 years in college, he left without a degree and served in the military before eventually returning to school to study drama in New York City at the American Theater Wing, supporting himself through odd jobs. He returned to college, got his degree in 1955. To discover the lower frequencies of the Mississippi in his timber, he spent hours learning to strip away his southern accent. Years spent in silence gave Jones an ear not just for what people conveyed with words, but also for all the accumulated meaning of voice, cadence, and articulation. He believed that understanding those details was the key to knowing a character. One of his earliest stage roles was as Othello in a summer production of Shakespeare's play in Michigan, a performance that foreshadowed his successful run in the early 60s as a fixture of the New York Shakespeare Festival, now Shakespeare in the Park. After the director Stanley Kubrick saw him in a production of The Merchant of Venice, Jones earned his first film role in Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove. As his stature grew, Jones would come to embody a strange paradox. He was synonymous with a voice that he wouldn't allow himself to hear. The risk, if he listened to himself, he might get caught up in his emotions and succumb to the old stutter. Instead, he learned to listen for and discover the voices of his characters. In Howard Sackler's 1968 play, The Great White Hope, Jones portrayed a lightly fictionalized version of Jack Johnson, the champion boxer whose defeat of several white competitors and public relationships with white women made him a target for racial harassment. Roles like that allowed Jones to tell the multitudinous stories of black men. His voice, arguably the most memorable in cinema, was as flexible as it was indelible, the tool he used to transform himself from a poet into an actor. Despite that, he remained a chameleon, embodying the authority of fatherhood in so many guises, the resplendent King Jaffe Joffer in Coming to America, the heartbroken, embittered, and abusive Troy Maxson in August Wilson's Fences, the stern and upright Mufasa in The Lion King, and the foreboding Darth Vader in the Star Wars franchise. Jones never imagined himself as representing that kind of authority, despite the unmistakable baritone that sounded as if it came from the hollowest part of a drum. For him, that was always the point. His discovery of language allowed him to understand in a different way the vital needs humans have for hearing and telling stories. And now a profile of Mary Weiss. She was born in 1948. Her singing career began and ended before she turned 20. This is a profile by Rob Horberger. Imagine you are a young girl growing up in poverty in New York City in the 1950s. Your father died when you were a few weeks old, and your family has been without a social safety net ever since. But there is a salvation, maybe the only one, rock and roll. You love Elvis and the Everly Brothers and soon discover that you have a voice too. You, your older sister, and two friends, also sisters, start harmonizing on street corners. The group moves on to sock hops and local shows, and then by some small miracle gets to record a couple of songs. They are frothy but forgettable, and escape, however fleeting. At that point, Mary Weiss, her sister Betty, and the twins Marianne and Margie Ganser could have gone back to high school and years later reminisced about that time we got to make a record. But one day in the spring of 1964, a former gang member turned songwriter named George Morton pulled over to the side of the road and scribbled out a few lines. Lines that turned into a song in search of a female voice. Just not the kind of voice that had been singing about soldier boys and boys so fine, parties and dancing and baby loves. This voice had to allow pain, the kind of pain so unbearable that the song needed a second section in which the anguish was whispered, alluded to, with a chorus of seagulls weeping in the background. The song found its way to 15-year-old Mary, who poured every bit of the struggle of her life into it. By the end of the summer, Remember, Walking in the Sand was shaking up the sunny, sparkly top 40 of the Beach Boys and the Supremes. The song's success whisked Mary and her group, called the Shangri-Las, out of their Queens neighborhood and into the Oz of show business. Building on Remember, they created what can only be called a kind of pop noir, and not just because in a few of their biggest hits like Leader of the Pack, people literally died. Their records had an authentic street sensibility, populated as they were by other side of the tracks characters, a repentant runaway, more than one noble greaser who loved hard and suffered hard. While much of the credit for the Shangri-La's hits has gone to the creative team behind them, few other singers could have pulled off that material, that attitude. In her lead vocals, Mary turned on the pathos, tap, and kept it running full. Even in the upbeat, Give Him a Great Big Kiss, she gave over-emoting a good name. It was also exciting, sharing a bill with the Beatles, hanging out at James Brown's house. But it wasn't long before it seemed the group had traded one grind for another. The overnight bus rides, the come-ons from fans and other musicians. Mary would wake up and not know what state she was in. You stop being a kid from Queens, and what you become is, well, a professional teenager, she said. She feared so much for her safety on the road that she started carrying a gun. That's no way to live, she said. By the time of the group's final chart entry, Past, Present, and Future in 1966, a haunting monologue set to Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata, the heavy emotionalism of their early hits had given way to a deep resignation. Margie Ganser left to get her high school diploma. The other members kept going until the group dissolved amid industry neglect and legal issues. Their records went out of print almost immediately. Mary Ann Ganser, who struggled with a drug habit, died in 1970. Mary married and divorced and remarried and went on to be a manager at a commercial architecture business. It would be 40 years before she released new music, a solo album called Dangerous Game. The Shangri-La's premature exit when Mary was still a teenager left them somewhere between footnote and legend. It would have been easy for her to wonder if her singing career had ever happened, given how much of it seemed to have been scrubbed from pop consciousness. Then one night, in the late 1970s, she walked into CBGB, the fabled downtown music club in Manhattan, for a rare reunion concert, and found Shangri-La's records on the jukebox. Turned out that groups like the New York Dolls and the Ramones were big fans, having been drawn to the Shangri-La's raw energy. Without the Shangri-La's, there would have been no Ramones, Joey Ramone told Mary. She would take it a step further. The Shangri-La's were punk before punk existed. More recently, Shangri-La's DNA was all over Amy Winehouse's classic 2006 album, Back to Black. I love the drama. I love the atmosphere. I love the sound effects, she said. After Winehouse died in 2011, Mary told the rock historian Creel Marcus, she could not stand fame any more than I could. I wish I could have helped her. On some level, though, Mary probably did. In their too brief career, the Shangri-La's gave voice to lost souls, and listeners who connected to the group's music might have felt a little less loss because of it. And now a profile written by Brett Martin. Wally Amos, born 1936. How Wally Amos made his cookies and himself famous. He was famous before he was famous, but names have power, and it didn't take long for reality to catch up. In March 1975, Wally Amos sent out 2,500 invitations to the opening of the first Famous Amos shop on a somewhat seedy corner of Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles. There was a valet parking and champagne. Amos printed glossy headshots of his new product, luridly bulging with chunks of pecan and chocolate. The conceit was that the former talent agent was promoting his newest client, the cookie. But it was Amos who was about to become a star. Raised in Tallahassee, Florida, with a teenage diversion to live with his Aunt Della in Harlem, Amos had already spent over a decade in show business after dropping out of high school. In the mailroom at the William Morris Agency in New York City, he used his lunch hours to practice his typing skills, eventually becoming the company's first black agent. He was responsible for signing Simon and Garfunkel. Passed over for a promotion, he set out on his own in 1967, opening a talent management company in Los Angeles. Along the way, Amos came up with a gimmick, bringing bags of homemade chocolate chip cookies to his meetings. He credited the inspiration to the ones Della used to bake for him. The resulting warm feelings paid off. Among the first investors in famous Amos were Marvin Gaye and Helen Reddy. With his beard, Panama hat, and flowing embroidered shirts, Amos was the picture of 1970s fabulosity, even managing to make his ever-present kazoo seem sort of groovy. For a stretch, he was everywhere, in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, on the cover of Time, featured on one of the Hot New Rich, on Taxi, as a hallucination of the character Latka. Sean Amos, one of Wally's four children, called his father part of the great American Negro hustler generation, alongside such figures as his one-time office neighbor, Quincy Jones. Young black men, born into Jim Crow America, now shaping American culture. Wally Amos himself resolutely avoided discussing race, even if it's difficult now to not read sly jokes into the t-shirts and bumper stickers he printed reading, "Have a Very Brown Day," or the event he hosted with Andy Warhol titled "Cookies and Milk with Amos and Andy." Still, it was no small thing to have the face of an actual black business owner join the Uncle Ben's, Aunt Jemima's, and Cream of Wheat men on supermarket shelves. 50 years later, it's still hard to think of any black food personality who has surpassed him in the public consciousness. As his shops, which quickly proliferated, Amos's small and irregular cookies were scooped from gold trays onto a butcher's scale and sold by weight, $3 per pound. In upscale groceries and department stores, they came in brown paper bags. Each was suggestive of a health food store or gourmet shop, though the cookies didn't really belong in either. His recipe had, in fact, come from the back of a bag of Nestle Toll House chips, albeit with some tweaks. Amos added coconut and pecans, swapped margarine for butter, and crucially upped the amount of chocolate. "He wanted there to be a chip and a nut in every bite," said Sean, who helped his father open the first store when he was 7 and often worked behind the register. Amos and his cookies were indivisible, right until they became all too divisible. He was a far better showman than businessman. In 1982, famous Amos took in $12 million in revenue. Only a few years later, the company was deep in the red. In 1985, it was bought for a song by the first in a long series of corporate owners, each of which diminished Amos's equity and involvement. Eventually, he was legally barred from using the very name that had set his destiny. It became a sort of existential capitalist ghost story, the man who lost his own name. Amos told it often, spinning the details of his failures into an improbable second career as a motivational speaker, author, and literary advocate. deprivation of anything which you think is rightfully yours is no more than a detour to a higher plateau, he wrote in Man with No Name, Turn Lemons into Lemonade, one of 10 books of mixed memoir and inspiration he published. This new identity provided more success than Amos's sporadic attempts to get back into the baking game, including one with one company cheekily named the Uncle No Name Cookie Company. It was the great pain of his life, Sean said, of his father losing his company. But ironically, it was also his next act. That is, by the end, Amos may have been most famous for no longer being famous. Great American hustler, indeed. And now a profile of Phil Donahue and Ruth Westheimer by Wesley Morris. Phil Donahue was born in 1935 and Ruth Westheimer, 1928. Together, they told us everything we wanted to know about sex. Before the answers to life's questions fit in our pocket, you used to have to turn a dial. If you were lucky, Phil Donahue would be on, ready to guide you toward enlightenment. In a stroke of deluxe good fortune, Dr. Ruth Westheimer might have stopped by to be the enlightenment. He was the search engine, she was the trusted result. Donahue hailed from Cleveland, the windshield glasses, increasingly showy thatch of hair, marble eyes, occasional pair of suspenders and obvious geniality, said card catalog, manager of the night of 79 Reds, stage manager in our Chevy Motors production of Our Town. Dr. Ruth was Donahue's antonym, a stepstool to his straight ladder. She kept her hair in a butterscotch helmet, fancied a uniform of jacket, blouse, skirt, and came to our aid via Germany with a voice of crinkled tissue paper. Not even 8 years separated them, yet so boyish was he and so seasoned was she that he read as her grandson. She may have reached his armpit. Together and apart, they were public servants, American utilities. There's a picture of them next to him. Phil's in a tuxedo, and Ruth has her arms around him, and she isn't as tall to reach his armpit. She's got her arms around him. She's in a purple dress. He's holding a beer in his left hand, and of course, they're both smiling. Donahue was a journalist. His forum was the talk show, but some new strain in which the main attraction bypassed celebrities. People, every kind of them, lined up to witness other people being human, to experience Donahue's radical conduit of edification, identification, curiosity, shock, wonder, outrage, surprise, and dispute, all visible in the show's televisual jackpot, cutaways to us, reacting, taking it all in, nodding, gasping. When a celebrity made it to the Donahue stage, Bill Clinton say, LaToya Jackson, the Judds, they were expected to be human. The Judds, they were expected to be human too, to be accountable for their own humanity. From 1967 to 1996, for more than 6,000 episodes, he permitted us to be accountable to ourselves. What Donahue knew was that we, women especially, were eager, desperate to be understood, to learn and learn and learn. We call his job host when, really, the way he did it, running that microphone throughout the audience, racing up, down, around, sticking it here, then over here, was closer to switchboard operator. It was hot dog vendor at Madison Square Garden. The man got his steps in. He let us do more of the questioning than he did. He would just edit, interpret, clarify. Egalitarianism ruled articulation too, and anybody who needed the mic usually got it. The show was about both what was on our mind and what had never once crossed it. Atheism, Nazism, colorism, childbirth, prison, rapists, AIDS, Chippendales, Chernobyl, Cher, name a fetish. Phil Donahue tried to get to its bottom, sometimes by trying it himself. Let us never forget the episode when he made his entrance in a long skirt, blouse, and pussy bow for one of the show's many cross-dressing studies. Now is the time to add that Donahue was a morning talk show. In Philadelphia, he arrived every weekday at 9 a.m., which meant that in the summers, I could learn about compulsive shopping or shifting gender roles from the same kitchen TV set as my grandmother. Sex and sexuality were the show's prime subjects. There was so much that needed confessing, correcting, corroboration, and ear lint. For that, Donahue needed an expert. Many times the expert was Dr. Ruth, a godsend, who didn't land in this country until she was in her late 20s and didn't land on television until she was in her 50s. Ruth Westheimer arrived to us from Germany, where she started as Carola Ruth Siegel and strapped in as her life corkscrewed as it mocked fiction. Her family most likely perished in the Auschwitz death camps after she was whisked to the safety of a Swiss children's home where she was expected to clean. The twists include sniper training for one of the military outfits that would become the Israel Defense Forces, maiming by cannonball on her 20th birthday, doing research at a Planned Parenthood in Harlem, single motherhood and three husbands. She earned her doctorate from Columbia University in education and spent her postdoc researching human sexuality. And because her timing was perfect, she emerged at the dawn of the 1980s, an affable vector of an era's craze for gnomic sages, Zelda Rubinstein, Linda Hunt, Yoda, masterpiece branding, and the nasty. Hers was the age of Mapplethorpe and Madonna, of Prince, Skinamax, and Two Live Crew. On her radio and television shows, in a raft of books and a Playgirl column, and through her promiscuous approach to talk show appearances, she aimed to purge sex of shame, to promote sexual literacy. Her feline accent and jolly innuendo pitched, among other stuff, the Honda Prelude, Pepsi, Sling TV, and Herbal Essences. Hey, she offers to a young elevator passenger, this is where we get off. The instructions for Dr. Ruth's game of good sex says it can be played by up to four couples. The board is volval and includes stops at yeast infection, chauvinism, and goosem. On Donahue, she is direct, explicit, dispelling, humorous, clear, commonsensical, serious, vivid, a professional therapist. It was Donahue who handled the comedy. On one visit in 1987, a caller needs advice about a husband who cheats because he wants to have sex more often than she does. Dr. Ruth tells Donahue that if the caller wants to keep the marriage and her husband wants to do it all the time, then what she should do is masturbate him. And it's all right for him to masturbate himself also a few times. The audience is here a pin drop rapt, or maybe just squirmy. So Donahue reaches into his parochial school student war chest and pulls out the joke about the teacher who tells third grade boys, don't play with yourself or you'll go blind. And Donahue raises his hand like a kid at the back of the classroom and asks, can I do it till I need glasses? Westheimer giggles, maybe noticing the large pear on Donahue's face. This was that day's cold open. They were children of salesmen, these two. His father was in the furniture business. Hers sold what people in the garment industry call notions. They inherited a salesman's facility for people and packaging. When a Donahue audience member asked Westheimer whether her own husband believes she practices what she preaches, she says this is why she never brings him anywhere. He would tell you and Phil, do not listen to her, it's all talk, which cracks the audience up. But consider what she talked about and consider how she said it. My favorite Dr. Tooth word was pleasure. From a German mouth, the word conveys what it lacks with an American tongue, sensual unfurling. She vowed to speak about sex to mass audiences using the proper terminology. Damn the euphemisms. People waited as long as a year and a half for tickets to Donahue, so they could damn them too. But of everything Westheimer pitched, of all the terms she precisely used, pleasure was her most cogent product, a gift she believed we could give to others, a gift she swore we owed ourselves. I miss the talk show that Donahue reinvented. I miss the way Dr. Ruth talked about sex. It's fitting somehow that this anti-dogmatic yet priestly Irish Catholic man would on occasion join forces with a carnal, lucky to be alive Jew to urge the exploration of our bodies while demonstrating respect, civility, reciprocation. They believed in us, that we were all interesting, that we could be trustworthy panelists in the discourse of being alive. Trauma, triviality, tubal ligation, let's talk about it. Fear doesn't seem to have occurred to them, or if it did, it was never a deterrent. Boldly they went, and with her encouragement, boldly we came. And now a profile of Pete Rose by Matt Flegenheimer. Banned from Major League Baseball, he turned his disgrace into a personal brand. He was born in 1941. Among the many indignities of being Pete Rose, and he was, for the last 35 years of his life, eager to tally them, one seemed to strike him as especially cruel. Here was a Cincinnati kid made good, so revered for his feats on the diamond that they made a street outside the ballpark Pete Rose Way, and yet he was not allowed in the clubhouse. I mean, that's the way you treat Al Capone, Rose told a local TV station shortly before his death, seated before a Warhol silkscreen print of himself. This was the Pete Rose Way. Defiant but pleading, self-regarding and self-pitying, self-semi-persuasive despite his persistent self-sabotage. As a ball player, Rose was a blazing throwback, relentless to the point of mania, the man fans called Charlie Hustle. His uniform was perpetually caked in infield dirt, his monkey's haircut convulsed on impact with each head-first slide. Sports writers summon near-carnal language to describe his dedication. There's something almost obscene about watching Pete Rose play baseball, one account began. Anything that someone enjoys that much must be illegal or immoral. He was a serial all-star across 24 seasons, most of them spent in Cincinnati, and the whirling motor of the Big Red Machine, as the team was known in its 1970s apex. His signature was the back-breaking single, swatted between fielders. His record of 4,256 career hits has stood for nearly four decades, as close to untouchable as Rose once was. No active big leaguer has more than 2,300. As a pariah, though, Rose was firmly ahead of his time. Allergic to introspection and undaunted by fact, he dissembled and bluffed through the game's greatest crisis in generations. His banishment from Major League Baseball in August 1989 for gambling on several sports, including his own, while managing the Cincinnati Reds. Rose publicly denied betting on baseball until he didn't, nearly 15 years later, when he had a book coming out. He denied betting on his own team before insisting that any worthy manager should have the conviction to do the same. He denied betting as a player before eventually winking about his years as a player-manager when he both set the lineup and carried a bat. For most of his exile, Rose's campaign for reinstatement and for inclusion in baseball's Museum of Greats in Cooperstown, New York, devolved into a kind of, sort of, not quite, apology tour that even he struggled to keep straight. "No way did I bet on baseball," he told Jane Pauley in 1991, after spending 5 months in jail for gambling-related tax evasion, "and I'll never admit I did." "Yes, I did," he amended in 2004, "and that was my mistake." Locked out of baseball, Rose subsisted on another strength, self-branding. In his reputational prime, he had pushed Wheaties, Kool-Aid, pancake houses in Cincinnati. The night he was banned in 1989, he made time to appear on a shopping channel hawking signed bats and balls. This form of commerce would become a kind of lifetime sentence, a reel of collectors, trade shows, and gawkers approaching him for a modest fee. It was a volume business. After moving to Las Vegas, little about late stage Rose was subtle. He said he worked 15 days a month, 5 hours a day, signing his name and posing for pictures, often from a table inside Caesar's Palace. At one point, he estimated his daily income for such labor to be $20,000. He also showed up to scribble in Cooperstown on Hall of Fame weekend, uninvited by the sports high priests, consorting with old teammates and rivals off campus until they returned to the official business of being legends and left Rose to putter in a memorabilia shop. Occasionally, the wider sports world cracked open its doors. 2015, Fox Sports hired him as a studio analyst, bow-tied, hair-dyed, before he was forced out 2 years later amid allegations of sexual misconduct in the 1970s. Rose acknowledged a relationship with a girl who was 16, the age of consent in Ohio, when he was in his 30s. Last year, Rose placed the ceremonial first legal sports bet at an Ohio casino, Cincinnati Reds to win the World Series. Throughout it all, the debate over Rose's bid for enshrinement was both reliable sports talk filler and a knotty proxy for the nation's attitudes toward misdeed and absolution. "Should forgiveness," a Rose biographer, Kostya Kennedy, once asked, "be granted only to the contrite?" It's too easy to imagine how Rose might have played this now as the accused in a 2024, navigating a post-shame cultural moment. He would pick winners on his hit podcast by day and dance with the stars in primetime. He would be the highest paid spokesman for the betting apps with which virtually every major sports league is now in business. He would find America's most powerful people celebrating his roguish arc. Major League Baseball should have allowed him into the Hall of Fame many years ago, President-elect Trump posted after Rose's death in September. "Do it now, before his funeral." Alas, Rose's sins date to the pre-post-shame age. His most consistent defense was a flailing whataboutism that could still sound coherent enough. Baseball history is rife with abusers and scoundrels whose plaques stand regardless. And none of them earned the Hit King title that Rose had stitched into his shirt collar as an old man. "I don't think I hurt you," he said. "I hurt me, and I hurt my family." That meditation came partway through a nearly four-hour docuseries released last summer, Charlie Hustle and the Matter of Pete Rose, a slow-rolling study in lessons not learned. In its closing frames, Rose considered the free market's appetite for remorse. In the past week, he said, he had scrawled, "Sorry, I bet on baseball on 1,000 balls. An order was out for 1,000 more. The demand baffled him." "People buy that ball," Rose said. "I don't know why, but they buy that ball." Now I'll read an interview with Jonathan Rumi. He plays Jesus to millions. It can get intense. The interview is conducted, as usual, by David Marchese. It's common, maybe even natural, for audiences to conflate actors with the roles they play. To assume, for example, that an on-screen action hero is tough off-screen, too. Or that a rom-com star is a real-life charmer. That blurring of lines is probably a sign that an actor is doing something right. But it doesn't make the dynamic any less strange or confusing, especially if the character you're famous for playing is Jesus Christ. Since 2017, Jonathan Rumi has starred as Jesus on The Chosen, a hit series that takes a prestige TV approach to the story told in the canonical Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Neither piously solemn nor portentously heavy-handed, The Chosen, which was created by Dallas Jenkins, son of the author Jerry Jenkins, a co-writer of the hugely popular Left Behind books, instead displays snappy dialogue, tense interpersonal drama, unexpected humor, and high production values. That slickly modern style, which allows the show to appeal to a curious non-believer like me, is centered on Rumi's warm and relatable portrayal, and it has helped the show become a gigantic success. To date, The Chosen, which is available for streaming on Amazon, Hulu, and other platforms, and will return for its fifth season next year, has been watched by more than 250 million people. All that positive attention has nudged Rumi, a Catholic, toward being a kind of faith healer. At public events for The Chosen, he can be swamped by fans looking to, as it were, touch the hem of his garment. He gets asked to deliver high-profile speeches at faith-based events attended by thousands. And in the online world, he has a partnership with the prayer app Hollow, where subscribers can hear him read scripture and lead meditative reflections. It's safe to say these opportunities were not on his radar before playing the Son of God. Rumi, who is 50 and was struggling in his career before landing The Chosen, is well aware that he's in an emotionally and psychologically complicated situation for an actor. But it's also a situation that he believes, anyway, is all part of a greater plan. And David asks, "What conversations did you and Dallas Jenkins have initially about the kind of Jesus that you wanted to show? Because your Jesus is very different from Jim Caviezel's in The Passion of Christ or William Defoe in The Last Temptation of Christ. It's more contemporary feeling, more colloquial." And he answers, "What we have that all those other portrayals didn't have access to was long-form storytelling. You're seeing the nuances of his character, his quirks. Nobody ever wondered, well, what would it be like to crack a joke with Jesus, to have a glass of wine with Jesus, to see him dancing at a wedding? Because if you're human, laughing and joking and frustration and the entire spectrum of emotions are part of the human journey, part of the struggle. He went through all of these things that we do so that we would have somebody to relate to as we're going through these trials ourselves. Before the chosen, maybe scuffling is too strong of a word, but you were a jobbing actor. And he says struggle busing. How does it happen that a struggle busing actor makes it big playing Jesus? I think that the path to that is absolute surrender to a higher power, because that's what it took for me to get to the place where I was ready for an opportunity like this. I had moved to LA and I struggled for 8 years. I was trying so hard to control my life, to control my destiny, to do the things that I thought needed to be done to have a successful career as an actor, and they weren't working. I was on government assistance that ran out. I woke up completely broke one morning. I didn't see any way out. So I literally said, God, you take this from me. It's in your hands. Now, I'm not going to worry about it. Then 3 months later, the chosen comes along. I thought, okay, I just needed to submit. When I watch videos of you giving talks, you come out to a wave of applause, an overwhelming response. That sort of attention combined with getting it for playing Jesus strikes me as a potentially psychologically and spiritually combustible situation. Does it feel that way to you? No. I recognize that none of this is about me. I don't matter in the grand scheme of things. When people react the way they do and people yell out, Jesus, they're seeing me as the face of the guy that they've had this response to while experiencing the show. Psychologically, they know I'm not Jesus, but they want me to be the next best thing. I, of course, cannot go anywhere near that reality. But that said, if I believe everything I believe about my faith, I'm in this position for a reason. I was cast as Jesus and somebody else wasn't. God only knows why. The thing I don't understand is how you separate the idea that, as you said, you're nothing, you don't matter. Dust in the wind, he says. But then you also feel as if you've been put here for a reason. Those seem like contradictory ideas. How do you reconcile them? I guess it's kind of hard to make that distinction. Yes, there's a sense of mission, and the mission is about Jesus. I was just in the Philippines, and it was nuts, man. I've never seen anything like it. They're so intense, and they were giving me stuff, little articles and notes and things. So I'm playing this character that people, for the most part, already love. They have a relationship with him. Then I come in, and I sort of fulfill their idea of who that person is. I'm also one of them, in that I have a relationship. A lot of fans know how I feel about Jesus and God and faith. So all of that combined, I think it's the reason for my career. If I believe in divine destiny, it's that I was meant to play this character at this time and place in history. So you go to these events and thousands of people are cheering. You are also asked to speak at the National Eucharistic Congress, or a commencement address at the Catholic University of America. You spoke at the March for Life in Washington last year. These are demands on your time and on your being. Do you feel as if you're being asked to give more than you have to give? It can be draining, the rigors of travel alone, but then human interaction. If I'm meeting you at one of these events, oftentimes they'll have VIP groups. Certain people get to have some one-on-one time, but there's 700 of them. That takes time and it takes energy. A lot of the time it's emotionally charged, for better or worse, that catches up with you. Is there a particularly difficult encounter that comes to mind? I was at a conference in a stadium of about 40,000 people. I came off the stage and shortly thereafter I got to the little green room where they had us hanging out. Security comes into the room and says, hey, there's a lady outside who's got a child in a wheelchair. She wants to know if she can say hello. I came outside and I met the lady and her son, and she was already overwhelmed. She then went on to tell me, our favorite episode is the episode where Tamar, one of the characters, lets her friend down on a stretcher in through the roof of Zebedee's house, and Jesus heals him, and he can walk again. And she says, I just thought, wouldn't it be great if the same thing happened to my son? And I said, yeah, that would be amazing. But I got to be honest with you. As far as I know, I don't have that gift. But I would love to pray with you if that's okay. I prayed with them for a minute, and they were so gracious and thanked me, and I walked away. Then I burst into tears because I thought, man, on some level, I must have let them down. But they know what I do. I'm not a healer. I'm not a preacher. I recognize that I can only be who I've been made to be. You talked earlier about the idea of surrendering to God. I think that for non-believers, the idea of surrender can sound like a cliche, like when an athlete talks about taking it one game at a time or giving 110%. Can you explain more concretely about what it actually looked like for you to surrender? I think the simplest way to describe it is arriving at the position of where I recognize that my ability to control my destiny, my fate, my path, ultimately is beyond me. Yet I have to participate in the process of moving forward, of achievement, of trying to follow the direction that I believe I've meant to go. When I came to that moment of surrender, I came to the conclusion that God had a plan for me. It's like he said, okay, I've given you these gifts, I've given you these talents, do something with them. And I'm kind of like, okay, let me go do something with them. For me, it was in a moment of severe stress and anxiety and borderline fiscal destitution that I basically said, I can't do it on my own. It was essentially a prayer where I said, I want whatever you want from me because you know better than I do what's good for me. Whatever that is, show me what it is. Give me the nitty-gritty on ways that your faith is still being tested. I'm a woefully flawed human being, but I'm trying to do the best that I can with the gifts that I've been given. And me even just walking the walk of faith publicly, it's not something that I ever intended to do. It's something that during the pandemic I felt pushed to do. I started praying live on my social media accounts. I thought, this is a career killer because it would out me as a Christian and then even more stringently out me as a Catholic Christian, which people find even harder to take. There are about, David says, there are about 1 billion Catholics in the world. There are, but I don't know that they're all here in America. The current president is Catholic, David says. But it just wasn't something I'd ever thought to do or felt that I should do. I'd always kept it separate. I just felt this inclination. You should do this because it's going to bring peace to a lot of people. I'm just trying to go where I'm led, man. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.